A meeting of the House Resources to order this afternoon, Thursday, April the 11th. And today, we have an old friend back, Mental Health Land Trust issue. We have calendared all legislation again today because we want to ensure that all of these bills get an equal opportunity before the committee. We are on teleconference, and it will be a listen-only teleconference, so welcome to you folks out there on the teleconference. I have a couple of other announcements or comments. We have an important issue for the state of Alaska before us, and it is the intent of this chairman to ensure that we do our part on the two bills that we're working on. And it seems that the options are either bill or a combination of these bills, or even perhaps something new. But something hopefully will go forth from this committee onto judiciary, and hopefully by the end of next week. That is my optimistic timeline. And I would ask if individual committee members need special assistance on more information or would like some briefing, please let us know. It is our intent that each committee member be up to full understanding of either bill that we have or exactly what it is that our committee would like to send out of here. But I would ask the committee to keep those timelines in mind and roll up our sleeves and get busy here so that the Mental Health Lands Trust issue goes forward. Today we will concentrate on sponsored substitute for House Bill 79 by Representative Mark Boyer. We will hear his opening statements, and then we will, at the request of Representative Boyer, hear from the plaintiff's attorneys, Mr. David Walker, Mr. Jess Jesse, and then also at the request of Representative Boyer, we will hear from Mr. Tom Smith, who is the acting director of the Division of Geological Survey of DNR. And after that, hopefully before 5 o'clock, we will hear from Mr. Tom Custer on the matter of the unilateral decision phrase. And also, we have Carol Wilson, I believe, if not here, on her way, hopefully, from the Department of Natural Resources, representing the commissioner. And with that, Representative Boyer, welcome again to our committee, and please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm actually going to be very brief because as a result of the hearing on Tuesday, it became clear to me that rather than perhaps focusing on the nitty-gritty language changes that have been made by the proposed sponsor substitute, that perhaps we ought to kind of look at some of the kind of larger, perhaps even more esoteric issues before we do that. And I just want to say that I appreciate the committee taking as much time as it has taken on this issue. And the sponsor substitute generally, though, represents a continuation of Senator Duncan's and my efforts to fashion what we think is a legitimate legislative solution to the mental health issue. And it's not a unilateral approach, but rather one that we've tried to develop, have developed it with the cooperation and coordination of the attorneys in this case, and the litigants and all the other parties involved. And I thought I would just start perhaps with the statement that has to deal with unilateral settlements, since that's kind of how we ended the discussion on Tuesday or Wednesday or whenever that day was. But if I think you all have in your packet the July Superior Court memorandum of decision and order with regard specifically to the preliminary injunction or the restraining, the preliminary injunction restraining issue that was before the court in July. And on page 8 of that is where the judge, Judge Meg Green, specifically talks about unilateral decision making here. I'm just going to quote a couple of quotes from her, but she said the fallacy of these arguments, and she's referring to the arguments that the state made in that particular in this case, the fallacy of these arguments is that they ignore the fact that the state may not unilaterally settle this lawsuit. The parties in this action and this court are under the mandatory remand of the Alaska Supreme Court to reconstitute, to match as nearly as possible the holdings which comprised the trust when the 1978 law became effective. Moreover, and here's what I think is perhaps the most important piece here too, the law of this case is that for the original breach, a compensation remedy is not adequate. This lawsuit will not come to its conclusion until a final adjudication on the merits reconstituting the trust is reached or a bilateral settlement is reached, which is approved by the court. That's essentially what the, that is what she said. And the distinction here that I think is has become confused is what is a bilateral approach and what is a court approach? And the attorneys, I'll ask them to speak to it, and Tom may want to speak to that too, because everybody clearly have a difference of opinion, and we, I think, do have differences of opinion. But I read that to suggest that either the court will literally meet with the state and the litigants and will come to something, an adjudication on the merits to reconstitute the trust, and that's something that's quite distinct and separate from our activities, but that's a court function with the people, with the state and with the litigants. That's one way to do it. Court, that's what Meg Green has said here. Or we bilaterally settle this thing by bringing the parties together. And what SB 65 and HB 79 attempt to do is form this, what we think of as a bilateral settlement to the issue that we hope then is taken to the court and approved by the court. That, those are the two ways that we can get to some kind of settlement. And so we have involved and engaged the parties here, and that's what, again, is represented by this piece of legislation. What I thought would be instructive for the committee would be to have the attorneys for the plaintiffs address why this legislation embodies a settlement from their perspective, a settlement of at least part of the issues. And you might recall that when we were selling the increment in the operating budget for the mental health program, we proposed a $21 million operating budget increment, about $8 million less than the Mental Health Board had recommended. But that is one piece of the settlement. Another piece of the settlement is to fully fund the capital requirements as defined by the Mental Health Board. So those three pieces, in effect, become the bilateral settlement in this whole case. If we fully fund the operating increment, fully fund the capital increment, and then embrace at least the concepts that are in this bill, I think we have a settlement. We have something that we can take to the court and settle this lawsuit. So, and then I also, because we talked or explored the issue last Tuesday of a land-only settlement, because some people are concerned about the cash aspect and whether or not, in fact, we have the ability to put cash into the settlement. I think, Mr. Chairman, you or at least started the discussion on a land-only approach to this, and several of us have been talking about it for weeks and exploring how that might shape and how it might manifest. And I think that I've asked Tom Smith to be with us so that he can explain exactly what it is that the Department of Natural Resources will be doing over the next two fiscal years in identifying the last selection lands to fulfill the state's entitlement, the roughly 20 million acres that we're entitled to, so that we'll have a sense of what information will be available from that process and whether or not that that information will be useful perhaps in making a selection of additional lands to fulfill the entitlement here. So if I can, Jeff and Mr. Walker, if you'd like to join us here. Dave and Jeff.
Another chair. Here, I think I can move mine up now.
That's okay, we have one right here. Representative Boyer,
yes.
Your pleasure. What is your pleasure regards the discussion on the unilateral bilateral issue? Would you like to have Mr. Walker and Mr. Jesse and then hear from Mr. Custer and then from these gentlemen again, or what is your pleasure?
Well, if we can focus on that issue for a moment and either agree or disagree or embrace, maybe we can do that. So have the opinions of the attorneys who've been directly involved with this, have them address that issue, and then perhaps move on to more why this bill is represents a piece of that. So
if you would, gentlemen, First, identify yourselves for the record, who you represent, and concentrate on, yes, we are in teleconference, concentrate on the unilateral, bilateral issue. Then we'll have Mr. Custer come forward, and then allow you gentlemen to come to return and have finishing remarks on the bilateral, unilateral issue, and then we'll continue on as you would.
Thank you.
So if you would, please continue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Walker. I'm lead counsel for the plaintiffs in the Mental Health Trust Lands litigation. And addressing initially the question of, as I understand it, posed by Representative Boyer about the unilateral and bilateral issue of the settlement, it's essentially a question of whether there is a settlement or a negotiated resolution or a litigated resolution of the issue. And although we might all use different language to characterize the agreement, I think that Representative Boyer has the essence of it. It is not at all unusual in litigation for the parties to do something other, this sort of litigation, for the parties to do something other than what they started out doing, or to do something other than the court orders. And in this case, the Supreme Court has ordered that the trust be reconstituted. Now, through years of struggling with that and years of effort by the Interim Mental Health Trust Commission and the administration and the legislature, the groups all considered that putting this trust back together under the constraints that would be imposed by the court were so difficult and posed so many hardships for governments and third parties that it was better to do something else. And without dragging a lot of those issues before you and prolong this part of the discussion, I would suggest that there are 4.5 pages of comments like that that are preliminary to Chapter 48. So if you look at Chapter 48 and you see the reasons that you enacted that law, and it sets out all of this reasoning why all of us together, the legislature and the administration and the plaintiffs, believed it was better to resolve or have a negotiated resolution of this case. What the judge is saying is that for there to be a negotiated resolution, there has to be a bilateral approach to it, and the parties have to agree upon a resolution. And sitting in the capacity of the judge in this case, because it's a class action suit, she will have to approve it. Failing that, failing agreement of the parties on a resolution and approval by the court, then the court will hear the issue, and that's the litigated solution. So there's the negotiated solution or the litigated solution. If there's not a negotiated agreement, there's a litigated solution. The court will hear argument from the parties on how the trust should be reconstituted in accordance with its view at that time.
Representative Carney?
I just wanted to ask Mr. Walker, how long would it take for a court, how long would you estimate it would take to reach a settlement if it was adjudicated?
I suppose that that's open to controversy. I believe that it certainly will take a long time, because it seems unlikely to me, as long as this controversy has gone on and as much disagreement as there has been and as much disagreement as there is presently about how that trust will be reconstituted, that it's not unlikely that one side or the other will be disappointed in the court's decision and will appeal that, and that decision will then have to be dealt with by the Supreme Court. That may or may not end it. It's certainly possible that there are issues involving the creation of a federal trust and beneficiaries that one party or the other might appeal on to the United States Supreme Court. So the answer is not soon.
Mr. Walker, I have a question. Now, we've been batting this one around a long time. In your professional judgment, from your perspective, all parties concerned, are we any closer today, say, than at the time of the Green decision, to resolving this either unilaterally or bilaterally?
Well, we're, from a technical standpoint, we are probably closer to resolving it unilaterally in that there are several motions pending before the court for action right now. And it is, I believe the litigated solution is it's a matter of record, I believe that is the preferred option of the administration. So to that sense, I would guess that we are closer to having a litigated type answer to this than we have been in the past, because in the past the parties were struggling for accommodation. It also seems to me, although your judgment in this matter is actually better than mine, far better, that we may be closer to a negotiated resolution, because the plaintiffs, if you will, plaintiffs' concern about what it takes to have a successfully negotiated resolution of this case are expressed by the coalition's briefing paper of October 2nd, and it said that's been in your packets, and it's on green paper.
Yeah.
And basically, I believe that the criteria for settlement are that there be a settlement which is fair to the beneficiary's best interest, that there be no question that a trust is established which is operated for the benefit of the beneficiaries and managed like a real trust, and that it be enforceable. And we've said at that time, in dealing with it, was in dealing with Senator Duncan's bill, I believe, rather than Representative Boyer's at that time, when we said, we will consider, we being the plaintiffs now, I'm speaking strictly from that point of view, not from the coalition or any other, said, I will consider any settlement proposal that meets those criteria. That's the criteria you have to meet. And Senator Duncan's bill does that. There may be other ways to do it, but we know that bill does it, and invited the legislature and the administration to come forward with some other proposal. Although that has not happened, it does appear to me that there's a possibility that we're closer to settlement of this than we have been, in the sense that there are proposals before you which all the plaintiff side of the case, the beneficiaries, have said, this may not be the only settlement, but these will do it. You want to settle the litigation, these bills will do it.
I would like to get back to you on some specific questions regarding these bills. The differences that separated the state and the litigants on the last go-around, I believe it was last summer, under the previous Department of Natural Resources. And we'll get back to that after we finish this unilateral bilateral thing. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I'm particularly interested in is how you, as representative of the litigants, are going to deal with the idea of the loss of the power of appropriation that is perceived or is real for people who sit where I sit. Because this is a very important issue, I think, if we're going to get there. Anyway, Mr. Jesse.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm an attorney representing a subclass of the beneficiaries, in the lexicon of the trust, the mentally retarded and the mentally defective. Maybe one way to go about looking at this unilateral, bilateral, I know it mostly comes up in talking about Representative Larson's bill. And one of the things that Representative Larson says about his bill is that it is not unilateral because it simply implements the direction of the Supreme Court in the Weiss decision. It's merely implementing the reconstitution of the trust. Now, I'll get into that more a little bit later, but if I could hand out some copies of the Weiss decision, there's a couple of parts of it that I want to point out right now about this unilateral bilateral issue that I think might be helpful. If you look at the very last page, the very back page, which is page 684, and look on the right-hand column in that first partial paragraph, you'll see that it says the case is remanded so that requisite findings can be made. And then it says we take this opportunity to provide some guidance to the trial court to simplify its task. One thing I'd like to draw to the committee's attention is that the Supreme Court's orders regarding reconstitution of the trust was not direction given to the state about what it should do. It was direction given to the lower court, the Superior Court judge in Fairbanks, to take this next paragraph and implement that as the means of reconstituting this trust. Now, certainly the plaintiffs may go to the court and explain what our view of what this last paragraph might mean. The state will certainly present their view of what that means, but the person that will, at least initially, decide how this trust is reconstituted is the court in Fairbanks, the Superior Court judge. Now, the reason that's important to this unilateral bilateral is that one of the things you have to look at is this paragraph that talks about putting all the land back in, those lands, to the extent or in the event that those general state lands, which were once mental health lands, will return to their former trust status. That's the first sentence. Those general grant lands, which were once mental health lands, will return to their former trust status. It doesn't say other lands. It doesn't say money. It says those lands are going to go back in, except the lands which were sold. Now, you know, everybody's going to spend a lot of time arguing over what this word sold means. But it's not possible for, in our view, this legislature, by passing a bill, whether it be Representative Larson's bill or anybody else's bill, to determine how the court interprets this language. That will be up to the court. Now, I don't think sometimes you have to be a lawyer to figure some of these things out. The term sold has a fairly common sense kind of an approach to it. It doesn't say anything in here about eminent domain. It doesn't say go back and reconstitute the trust pursuant to the application of a concept of eminent domain to the entire million acres. This is something new that's being added to this language being sent by the Supreme Court back to the Superior Court. And we shouldn't be confused into thinking that because someone says this is simply implementing what the Supreme Court says, then in fact it does in fact do that. We are adding a whole new element to what the Supreme Court has said when we purport to apply the principle of eminent domain as a key element of the methodology by which this trust will be reconstituted. Now, I'll go into this in more detail when we get back to talking about Representative Larson's bill. But in terms of the unilateral bilateral issue, that in our view takes it away from simply being a reconstitution pursuant to the Supreme Court decision. It is not. It is a unilateral attempt to shape how that reconstitution takes place. A unilateral attempt that, in our view, the court would not accept, will not accept, and will go through what they believe to be the proper way to reconstitute the trust, notwithstanding anything that may be an attempt in a bill to direct them in a particular direction.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. Are there questions or comments by members of the committee?
Yes. Yeah.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you. Does that mean that the courts would be less amenable to accept a cash settlement instead of a total reconstitution of those lands? I'm trying to hear what you just said. It sounded to me like you're making a strong case where every acre that was selected must go back according to the courts. Is the court saying that, or are they saying that you can
They're saying that every acre that was selected, that particular piece of land, land is unique, that particular chunk of ground has to go back into the trust, except for those lands which were sold from the date of conveyance, which is 1978, when they purported to redesignate the land as general estate lands, up until this decision, which takes away their ability to continue to sell lands. Only those lands sold in that period of time can remain in whatever hands they're in. Every other piece of ground has to go back into the trust.
So, and could you, I don't know if it's necessary, or maybe the Boyer wants to talk a little bit about fair market value, because that seems to be a big...
Well, before you go on to that, on the issue of those lands sold, now those are truly the lands that then some people are calling the third-party hostage lands. Is that correct? And it simply is not the case. If we're talking strictly about those lands that were sold. Mr. Walker?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. I mean, in our view, in terms of talking about the unilateral aspect of, in our view, Mr. Jesse has described the meaning of the word sold, and so the trust will, in our view, be reconstituted containing all of those lands except those lands which were sold.
So, to make it perfectly clear, then, those lands which were sold are one group. Those lands which were exchanged are another and should go back into the trust. Those lands which were designated or given to municipalities, they go back into the trust. Is that clearly what we're talking about?
That's clearly the plan's position.
Representative Boyer.
I don't think we need to get off into the issue of fair market value just yet, but you need to remember what Jeff said in the beginning, which is that this is the Supreme Court's direction to the court here, that it do that. Now, the court will do that all by itself if we don't act. The Superior Court will do that, do something like that, because that's what it's been charged with doing. In the alternative, we can form a settlement, which isn't that. It doesn't necessarily mean that. It doesn't have to look like that. It doesn't have to sound like that. But it has to be a settlement, and it has to be bilateral. And it would mean literally where the plaintiffs and the attorneys and the state walked into the court with something, we think it's a piece of it is SB 79 or HB 65, and said this represents a settlement for us. So then it isn't that. But that's the only way that it isn't that. Those lands.
Mr. Jesse.
If I might add one thing. Now, the Supreme Court wasn't specifically referring to any definition of sold. I mean, we can't find in here where they define the term sold. And I have no reason to know that they were looking back at the Enabling Act. But if you go back and look at the Enabling Act, what you'll see is that the legislature was empowered to deal with these proceeds and this land. And these lands may be sold, comma, leased, comma, mortgaged, comma, exchanged, comma, or otherwise disposed of. Now, that clearly sets sold, at least in this listing of sold as opposed to other things you do, apart from many other kinds of transactions, which comprise the bulk. And keep in mind, it is only those lands which will qualify as sold in this period of time, between 1978 and 1985, which will remain in any third-party hands. So in our view, very, very few acres will remain outside of the trust. The vast, vast bulk, perhaps in excess of 95% of the land, will be returned, those acres returned to the trust.
So let me ask, if there was land exchanged to a Native corporation, which was subsequently sold, where do we fit that in?
Sold by the Native corporation?
Yes.
The question is one of title and whether you have the ability to transfer title. I mean, in our view, unless the lands were purchased by a bona fide purchaser for value, sold, who didn't have notice of the breach of trust, then those lands will be returned to the trust. So I think those lands are part of the lands that we would contend will be returned to the trust. The people who relied on it aren't without remedy. It's just not against the beneficiary of the trust.
That's the lis pendens issue, is that correct? Or however you say that?
No, the lis pendens is simply something that puts everyone on notice that this litigation is pending.
Representative Carney?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reading this section, it sounds to me as though what they're saying is that in the event of an exchange, that you follow those lands that were received in exchange for mental health lands, and those lands then are subject to being included in the trust. In other words, you don't take that land back. You get the value from that and include it in the trust. Am I wrong?
If the language says that the exchange lands will be put into the trust, then they would be.
It says in the event exchanges have been made, those properties which can be traced to an exchange involving mental health land will also be included in the trust.
To the extent that those lands were included in the trust, they would be part of the trust corpus, and that any difference in value would be a liability of the trust.
Right.
Representative Boyer?
I would just like to make a comment that it's this kind of frustration and this kind of exact focusing that is the reason why we stood back from this whole set of issues before and said this is going to be too much, it's going to be too controversial, it's going to be costly, it's going to be time consuming. That's why the 4.5 pages in Chapter 48 are there. They kind of embrace all of this kind of thing and say, let's move beyond it. Let's determine a value and then either reconstitute with land or money, the trust, so that we don't have to keep focusing on all of these things, because we'll get nowhere. This legislature would never get anywhere. And that's why some of us think it's much easier to now move forward and forget those issues. We have a value. We want to embrace the value. It's $2.243 billion. It's relatively esoteric. But it keeps us from having to deal with all of these other issues. Again, the legislature, 5 years ago now, almost 5 years ago, decided that we didn't want to deal with those issues. And I think that a little bit you can brush up against it, these issues with this year, will lead us all back to that. But that's not the direction we want to go.
We're going to move on shortly. Representative Carney?
I understand Representative Boyer's frustration and impatience to proceed. You've had more experience with this than I have, and I think it's important that we finally lay to rest forever the possibility of adjudication. And I know that Representative Larson's bill heads us in that direction as a solution. In other words, a unilateral solution, going to the court and saying, this is what we propose, will you buy it? And I want to try to determine what we'd be looking at in the length of time and how much it's going to cost us and the potential for settling that way. I don't think it doesn't sound as though it's possible, but I'd like to pursue it. And you know, I'm hearing that the first sentence in this last paragraph, it says the lawsuit will not come to the conclusion until a final adjudication on the merits of constituting the trust is reached. And I've heard your interpretation of that. I know that the administration seems to be heading in that direction. I'd like to hear from Mr. Custer to see if he's coming from a different place, if he has a different interpretation of that, for my own personal satisfaction.
Gentlemen, thank you very much, and we'll hear from you again shortly. Mr. Custer, if you would come forward. Representative Boyer, Uncle, after Mr. Custer gives us some remarks, or the administration position, I don't know if I'm mischaracterizing your situation. I'd also like to hear from Mr. Jay Hogan of Mr. Larson's staff, if you have no objection, and then go back to the plaintiff. Do you have any problem with that?
No.
Mr. Custer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Custer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law, and I've been representing the state in the Weiss litigation to date. The only clear question that I can remember from the discussion that's been going on so far is, what is the difference between a bilateral settlement and resolution through a final adjudication on the merits of the case? And I think Mr. Walker did a very commendable job in terms of describing what that is. A bilateral settlement, or any kind of a settlement, is where the two parties to the lawsuit agree on an outcome. And because this is a class action, that outcome then would be subjected to independent scrutiny by the judge, so that not only are the parties satisfied with the outcome, but the judge as well is satisfied that the outcome satisfies the requirements of law, in this case the 1956 Federal Mental Health Enabling Act. The alternative to that approach is where the legislature, as it does with any law, decides that this is going to be the policy of the state of Alaska, whether it's in the criminal context or some, or any other context. The legislature decides this is what we believe is the appropriate resolution of this particular problem that we are called upon to deal with. Someone that is aggrieved by that outcome, that legislative outcome, then has the power to take it to the court to say, Your Honor, we believe you ought to adjudicate this legislative result as not within the legislature's power, that is, exceeding the legal constraints on the legislature. And the court adjudicates the case on the merits, decides either that the law is valid, a valid exercise of the legislature's power, in this case, a valid discharge of the state's obligation as trustee under the Mental Health Enabling Act, or determines that it is not. The one case that we've had so far in this context is the 1985 Weiss decision, where the Supreme Court said the 1978 legislation, which took the entire corpus of the Mental Health Trust, redesignated it as general grant lands, and then didn't pay anything for it, was invalid. It was a breach of the federally created trust. That's the one judicial determination that we've had in this area. And that was a situation that was adjudicated on the merits, the court concluding that the legislature exceeded its authority and in fact breached its duty as trustee.
Representative Boyer?
Let me see if I can get a kind of recharacterize Representative Carney's question, though, in the context of Meg Green's July decision, because the question is whether or not if we passed a Larson bill, something like a Larson bill, whether or not that meets, you know, either one of these little tests here, and I think it doesn't, and I want your opinion on whether or not it does, because of what Meg Green, we're not taking this back to the Supreme Court, it goes back to Meg Green. Meg Green has said the state's principal arguments in each of these pending injunction pieces, that the state's arguments was that subsequent acts of the legislature in the enactment of Chapter 48 and 1990 amendments in Senate Bill 493 have changed the situation so that the state is no longer a breach of the fiduciary, i.e. that we had done something. We had unilaterally acted to do something, not unlike, I think, if you pass Larson's bill absent an agreement atmosphere, you pass Larson's bill, that she would then say the fallacy is that the state cannot act unilaterally to settle this lawsuit. I mean, that you have to see them both in context. I think that if you passed a Larson bill in absence of a settlement atmosphere, that she would say and hold again that it's unilaterally moving and that that's not going to get you out of court.
And you wish for Mr. Custer's comment
on that? I mean, Mr. Custer, see if we agree or disagree on that.
I think, assuming that it went to Judge Green, now one of the features of Representative Larson's bill is that the valuation determination, as I understand in the sponsor substitute, is vested under the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. If we're concerned about time, it seems to me there's no reason in the world the legislature could not provide in whatever bill it approves that this approach should be subjected to the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. And that certainly would eliminate one step. It would eliminate the Superior Court step requiring a subsequent appeal to the state Supreme Court. We have looked at it. At least at the staff level in the Department of Law, the Attorney General has not yet had a chance to review our conclusions, but we do believe the legislature has the authority under the state constitution to define the jurisdiction of courts and could in fact vest the Alaska Supreme Court with both original and exclusive jurisdiction to review the merits of any approach the legislature takes. And that would cut down on the time involved because it would eliminate the step of moving through the Superior Court before going to the Alaska Supreme Court, which is the final arbiter in this state. As Mr. Walker indicated, because we're dealing with a federal law, there would be an opportunity at least for someone to petition the U.S. Supreme Court to review that. Whether the U.S. Supreme Court would agree to do so is problematic. The normal course of proceedings in the U.S. Supreme Court, however, is that from the motion the petition is filed until a final adjudication by the U.S. Supreme Court is between 12 and 15 months. So it's a relatively short time frame, certainly shorter than we're accustomed to in the courts of this state. I think if the legislature were to take an approach like the Larson approach, that it would go before a judicial tribunal. And whether that judicial tribunal would uphold it or not uphold it is problematic. No one can predict with certainty. The Larson approach, however, invokes a concept that the state Supreme Court has, in fact, already validated in the 1980 University of Alaska case, where the University of Alaska was given 100,000 acres of land. The legislature took 5,548 of those acres, put them in Chugach State Park. And the Supreme Court in the university case said, because the legislature has the constitutional authority over state lands, it indeed does have the power to take these lands from the trust and dedicate them to non-trust purposes, so long as the trust is fairly compensated. Because the legislature did in fact dedicate these lands to the specific purpose of a park, that was a valid exercise of the legislature's authority. The university is entitled to compensation. What Representative Larson's bill does, as I understand it, is to look at the original million-acre corpus of the Mental Health Trust and say, we're going to reconstitute the Mental Health Trust with this million acres, but we've dedicated about 800,000 of those acres to other purposes. That's what we're going to recognize, place the unencumbered lands that we have remaining, the 200,000 unencumbered lands, as a land corpus, create the authority and allow it to deal with the state in terms of a combination of monetary compensation and land compensation. Now, the reason the Alaska Supreme Court did not follow its University of Alaska rule in Weiss is set out on that same page that Mr. Jesse referred to. It's the beginning discussion. If you start at the very bottom of page 683, the court cites that university case, and it says, State versus University of Alaska does not compel a different result. That is a result of invalidating the 1978 legislation. In its discussion, the court contrasts the two situations. In the university case, the legislature took 5,540 acres and dedicated it to a specific purpose. Here, the court said, this was a million acres with potentially no use at all. And it makes no sense to conclude that the legislature would have taken all that land and intended to compensate the trust for it. You'll notice, unlike the situation in University of Alaska, the present case does not involve a disposition of a portion of trust lands for a specific use. Now, you'll recall that, in effect, that's what Representative Larson's bill does. It disposes of a portion, not the entire corpus, and for a specific use. They're articulated. They're encumbered. They're placed in legislative designations. They've been transferred to third parties. Instead, the entire corpus of the trust is intermingled with the general grant lands of the state. Well, that's certainly not true in Representative Larson's bill. A portion of those are taken by the power of eminent domain. Another portion are returned to trust status, not mingled with the general grant lands of the state. No particular use of the trust lands is specified, and it may be years before much of the land is used. Well, the lands that are in Representative Larson's bill taken by eminent domain are most assuredly used. They're being used for parks. They're being used for conveyance to municipalities. They're being used for conveyances to third parties. They're leased. There are rights of way on them, easements. While it was reasonable to infer a legislative intent to pay for 5,040 acres for which there was a present parkland use in University of Alaska, it is not reasonable to infer that the legislature meant to pay for a quantity of trust land approaching 1 million acres for which in large part there is no present use. Representative Larson's bill makes clear that the lands that are being taken are for a present use, and there is a very clear, not an inferred, but an explicit legislative intent to compensate the trust for those lands. So it's a much different situation if Representative Larson's bill was passed than the court was faced when it adjudicated the 1978 legislation. Lawyers can certainly argue about whether or not the court would conclude that this was an appropriate discharge of the state's obligation as trustee? In my view, it would be, particularly since the court in both the University of Alaska case and here in the Weiss case acknowledged this rule that the legislature can, in fact, take trust land if it is dedicated to specific use, and there is an inference that the legislature intends to compensate the trust for the taking of that land. That's what Representative Larson's bill says. That's what it proposes to do. I believe the Alaska Supreme Court would, in fact, uphold that. The question, though, that I think the legislature, to the extent that these are two proposals that are on the table, the question the legislature must ask is, which is more costly? Taking the time to find out if that approach works, in which case, as far as land management goes at least, perhaps not as far as programs, but as far as land management goes, the question's resolved. Either it works or it doesn't work. Or does the legislature want to take the approach that's on the table in Representative Boyer's bill and Senator Duncan's bill, which includes a large cash settlement, a large land settlement, and a large program settlement? I think those are the three elements that we're talking about here. And which is more costly to the state? That's really the policy question that needs to be answered.
Representative Carney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only other thing I can think of is the length of time is going to be very expensive for the state of Alaska. It takes 2 years to adjudicate the unilateral settlement.
Well, it's not a unilateral settlement. It's not a unilateral resolution. It's a determination by the court either that the state has acted consistently with its obligations or it has not acted consistently with its obligations. In terms of the cost, I think one must look at, is that 2 years the cost, whatever it would take for the year, for the 2 years, whatever it might be? The cost of an alternative approach that is bilateral. And you know, we can get economists in here and they can look at what are the costs to the state in the long run, because I think we should recall that a bilateral settlement that is approved by the court presumably will last in perpetuity. So to the extent its costs, to the extent there may be costs associated with that approach that exceed the costs associated with an alternative, the costs of the bilateral settlement approved by the court are costs that will continue to recur time after time after time.
Continue, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I can say is your arguments are very good, and in a lot of ways I agree with them. I think that the proposal we have on the table is too expensive, but it is at least going in the direction of a bilateral agreement. If we could reach an agreement on that general basis that was not quite so expensive and perhaps give the legislature more control of the asset, it might be acceptable. And other than that, we're back in court for a couple of years, I guess.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you. Tom, you said House Bill 59 does settle the lands issue and the monetary issue and the management issue. In your mind, does it settle the management issue on a constitutional way? That is, would the Constitution permit us, if we pass this legislation, would it abrogate or violate the appropriation process that is reserved to the legislature?
Were you referring to House Bill 59 or House Bill 79?
79. Which one am I looking at? 79. Yeah, 79, I'm sorry. Yes.
All I can do is give. If we're looking at House Bill 79, all I can do is sort of give you my initial reaction, and the Attorney General has not reviewed those, and so I'm a little reluctant to say this is the Department of Law's position. And perhaps the safest course is to simply say that it raises a number of questions in my mind, and questions that the Attorney General needs to make the final call on. But at least in terms of what in law school we hopefully are trained to do, and that's spot issues, at least there are some issues that it does raise. One of the issues, obviously, is the dedicated fund question. And there are two elements to the dedicated fund question here. One is that all of the income from the corpus of the trust is initially, at least, subject to disposition by the Mental Health Trust Authority. That authority does have the power to dedicate all of the income to mental health programs if it deems that's what is required in its view to discharge the state's obligation as trustee. In the Mental Health Enabling Act, however, and one of the exceptions to the dedicated fund prohibition is where dedication is required for participation in a federal program. One of the problems here is that in the Mental Health Enabling Act, Congress made it quite clear, at least in my view, and I have not heard anyone seriously disagree with this proposition, Congress made it quite clear that it was in fact not dedicating all of the revenue from mental health trust lands to mental health programs. No one knew how much these lands were worth. No one knew how much income they would generate. No one knew how much the territory and subsequently the state's mental health program would cost. There was great testimony about the problems they ran into in the state of Texas. And those of you that have studied the Constitutional Convention will recall that the problems in Texas were one of the primary reasons our founding fathers put a dedicated fund prohibition into our Constitution. So the parallel is really very, very close here. The congressman from Texas pointed out that by dedicating the Railroad Commission lands to the benefit of the University of Texas, the University of Texas had more money than it knew what to do with. And many other programs in Texas were going begging, but there was not really anything that could be done about it, because it had a vested constituency, and as you all know, it's much harder to change a law once it's enacted than to get a law enacted in the first place. So I think there is a problem from that standpoint. There's another problem as to whether the legislature can delegate its budgeting authority to the Mental Health Trust Authority, which is what's considered here. The Constitution is very clear about the process and mechanism within which a budget is to be generated. The governor proposes, the legislature appropriates, the governor has the line item veto power, and the legislature has the power to override. And that is a constitutional mechanism by which public funds are spent for state programs, which would not be incorporated in this proposal. The Constitution calls on the legislature in Article 7 to legislate for public health and to legislate for public welfare. There's a delegation issue whether the legislature does have the power, in fact, to delegate the authority to determine what is to be the state's comprehensive mental health program, as House Bill 79 would do. Now, I'm not saying that these are fatal, and I have not concluded that, in fact, that it would violate the Constitution if enacted in its present form. But those are certainly questions that, over and above very serious policy questions, I mean, I think they're serious policy questions that the legislature must deal with, but they also are questions that have a constitutional aspect, because the way our Constitution is written and the way the Constitution looks to the legislative branch of government to, in effect, make so many of these kinds of decisions, or at least be involved in them. I hope that was responsive.
Well, may I please continue, Representative Hudson? Trying to come up to speed to all the ramifications of this issue is extremely difficult, so if I'm off base, well, you'll bring me back on. But I'm looking again at the handout that was recently referred to, Public Law 830, on page 712. In that, it indicated that all lands granted, we're going back, I think the prior attorneys indicated that all the lands would be reconstituted to the trust. And so if we deal with the lands issue on one side, and the program side, I think, and this whole appropriation thing is the one that's got me most vexed. And I look at subparagraph E, and it says, all lands granted to the territory under this section, together with the income, shall be administered by the territory of Alaska, and I assume that's the legislature, as a public trust, with the proceeds applied first to the expenses. And nothing in here says that
you, even in this enabling legislation, Public Law 830, says that anybody other than the legislature ought to manage the programs. Is that the way you read them?
Mr. Chairman, again, I think you will find a significant disagreement, as there has been over most of these issues. My view of this 1956 law has always been to begin with the basic purpose of the law. What was the purpose of the 1956 law? The purpose of the 1956 law was to place the territory of Alaska in the same position as all other states and territories. That is, to give it the authority to deal with its own mental health problems. The impetus for the law in the very beginning was that the territory was legally precluded from dealing with its own mental ill. It was a national government responsibility, and the national government was doing, frankly, a terrible job. And Alaskans were justifiably outraged. They wanted the legal authority to make their own judgments and their own determinations. So the fundamental purpose was to put the territory of Alaska in an equivalent position to all other states to deal with this issue. In the very beginning sections of the law, Congress says the territorial legislature may enact such laws as it deems appropriate for the care of the mentally ill of Alaska. So the power is vested explicitly in the territorial legislature. As far as I know, there is not a single state where the federal government has required that state to create a new entity outside its legislature to make those decisions. And to me, to read the 1956 law as requiring that that be done violates and frustrates the basic purpose of the federal law, which was to give Alaska the same power that other states have, including the power of the legislature to make these kinds of decisions.
Senator Duncan?
May I ask a question, Representative Westminster?
Certainly. But we should not stray too far from unilateral bilateral.
I want to get kind of back that and ask Mr. Custer a question, and I think it's important to get Mr. Jesse and your. However you might handle it, Mr. Jesse, Mr. Walker, back. Because I sat here and listened with interest, you made it sound very easy and simple for the legislature to decide to reconstitute the trust along the lines of Representative Larson's bill, for example, and to pass a statute bypassing the Superior Court and going directly to the Supreme Court, that we could do that very easily and therefore avoid a problem spot for the administration to don't happen to agree with settlement provisions and don't agree with the decision of Judge Green on you can't do it unilaterally. So we could bypass that very quickly. I'm assuming in that whole process, however, that the beneficiaries, the attorneys for the beneficiaries, would oppose that type of action before the Supreme Court. And so you'd be into some type of a long-term protracted court battle at that point. Is that correct? And it's just not that simple to do.
Right? I prefer not to speak for the attorneys for the beneficiaries, and they can answer part of that question.
But I think did do that.
I think if past history is any indication, there would be disagreement over a variety of things, perhaps over the legislature's authority to establish the jurisdiction of courts, even though the Constitution says the legislature may do that, perhaps over whether this is an appropriate case for the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. I think there are a variety of things that can be argued about.
Could be litigated.
And that's certainly possible.
In addition, I think probably the question of whether or not the Supreme Court would reverse its decision that it made in 1985 about what reconstitution means, et cetera, all that would be part of what would be
argued. It certainly would. And all I'm saying is that in my view, where the Supreme Court has acknowledged the legislature's power to take land through the power of eminent domain in the University of Alaska case, and said that the 78 legislation was a different situation, that if the case went back to the Supreme Court in a scenario that was closely analogous to the university case, I believe the court would follow the university case and, in fact, would say this once again, is a different case than what we had adjudicated in 1985. I do think there is that in terms of how this case goes to the court and how long it takes is more a function of the importance that the court puts on the case and the good faith and goodwill of the parties in seeking an expeditious resolution. And that is something that, that this body certainly could expedite were it to simultaneously with something like a bill, whatever that bill might be, number one, at least try to get it in the state Supreme Court. Presumably the parties want an answer and in good faith would agree to allow that forum to adjudicate it. And second, pass a joint resolution urging the court because of the tremendous public interest and the harm that is being visited on the public right now because of the current status quo, and urge the court to treat it as an expedited matter.
Mr. Chairman, I want to try to get to my question if I can. Mr. Custer needs to make those arguments to the Supreme Court in order for them to act quickly, I appreciate that. I guess the point that I wanted to make is not, you say expedite. Expedite doesn't mean expedite like we normally think, because every step of the way, undoubtedly, and I'm not speaking for the attorneys either from the other side, there will be counter motions and there will be ongoing litigation that will involve a whole lot of things. And we don't know how long it could take. It could take knowing how courts work and how motions are filed and et cetera. And I think they would give importance to this case, and they'd also give importance to the beneficiary's position. They'd give importance to their ruling in 1985. They'd give importance to Judge Green's decision. Not easily resolved. It's going to take some time, whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. I would guess it's in 2 or 3 years or longer. My question would be, in your mind, during that period of time, would the injunction be lifted? Would title be cleared? Would the third-party interest be able to go ahead with their development? Would the title be clear as far as the conveyances that went to municipalities? Or would we be in this limbo state for a long period of time waiting for this decision to be rendered by the Supreme Court on all these questions that would come before it as a result of the legislature taking unilateral action and then asking to bypass the Superior Court going directly to the Supreme Court? You understand my question? Would title be cleared, or would we have title tied up for an indeterminable amount of time?
I would be remiss to say that I know the answer to that. I can guarantee.
Sure.
I can. Okay. My speculation is that, assuming a variety of scenarios, that a bill is passed that speaks to the legislature's power or the state's power of eminent domain, recognizes the concept of inverse condemnation recognized by the Alaska Supreme Court in the university case with respect to trust lands dedicated to a specific purpose with a legislative intent to compensate, with jurisdiction vested in the Supreme Court, original jurisdiction vested in the Supreme Court to adjudicate it. It is my view that the Supreme Court would lift any injunction and title would be cleared. The court would conclude that, given, just like in the university case, where the land was taken by inverse condemnation, no one knew how much it was worth. No one knew how much the university was going to get for that land at the time the Supreme Court made its decision. No one knew the answers to any of those questions. But the court said, nonetheless, that legislation is valid. And because it's valid, those acres are in the park, dedicated to non-trust purposes, and the state and the university can worry about compensation later. And that's why there were not the holdups with university land while the legislature deliberated the university settlement. And I believe the same result would be true here.
Mr. Chairman, I can't argue, of course I'm an attorney, so I can't argue at this point, but I think common sense tells us several things, and I'd like to hear from Mr. Jesse and Mr. Walker on this point. Common sense probably tells us that the Supreme Court is not going to quickly lift that injunction that the Superior Court put on, especially if what we do in the legislature is unilateral, for one, goes contrary to what the Supreme Court ruling was in 85 into the Judge Green decision, and you've got active attorneys on the other side filing opposing motions. So I think the answer is, and I, you know, maybe I shouldn't have asked you to speculate, because I didn't expect to speculate any other way what the administration would like to have it come out. So I think the answer is, no one knows for sure, but probably we're looking at titles being tied up for a long period of time, and we haven't resolved the problem for years if we go the way that you're advocating.
Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to advance this a little bit along the same lines. Ms. Custer, you said the big question is which is more costly? And here we are, many of us who are coming into this relatively recently, and you've been dealing with it for a number of years, and I kept listening for the hints as in terms of which you thought would be more costly, and I think that I can read between the lines. Could you tell us, you know, maybe you have to speculate, because there's lots of ifs. I know, and I recognize you're putting a lot of conditions on this, you know, if you do this and this and this, and if the court does this, but what do you think is more costly?
I think in terms of, it's a bit like comparing apples and oranges, unfortunately, in terms of weighing comparative costs, because not all of them are reducible purely to dollars and cents. One of the current status quo and the continuing status under Senator Duncan's scenario, where title is not cleared and there continues to be a cloud on title for years and years and years, is terrible hardship on a number of third parties. And I include in that certainly the people to whom the state has sold land, who have paid off their contracts or are in the process of paying them off, and the state is unable to issue a patent to them because of the injunction. I include in that the municipalities to whom the state has conveyed land. I include in that the lessees of the state, including Idemitsu and the Wishbone Hill Coal Project, 200 jobs in the Matsu Valley, which cannot be implemented because the state cannot approve a coal mining project. The psychological discomfort suffered by those that enjoy state parks and wildlife refuges that have some of these lands, mental health lands, included in them. Those are all costs, and not all of those can be measured in dollars and cents. I think ultimately, if you wanted to say we're going to do nothing but what the Supreme Court said, and the way we're going to do it is we're going to use our power of eminent domain, we're going to go back and we're going to condemn all those third-party interests and pay them off for the fair market value of those lands, there is a significant cost associated with that, a very significant cost right out of the state treasury. But that's not the big cost there. I mean, the big cost is the hardship and the grief suffered by those third parties. On the other hand, the other approach has costs as well. Costs like, is this, even if the court finds it constitutional, is it an appropriate public policy expense to delegate the authority to appropriate, to delegate the authority to establish what programs are, to delegate the power to decide how much will be spent on each of these and what is a necessary expense for all of them. I think in terms of dollars and cents, it's probably a greater cost, but that solution is a greater cost to the state treasury if you only want to talk dollars and cents. But again, that's not the major cost. The major cost is we have a constitutional system that talks about how the appropriation process is to work, who is to be responsible for determining what public policy is in terms of program development. And one approach would, in effect, delegate those functions to an authority that is not responsible to the electorate, it's not responsible to the legislature, it's not responsible to the executive branch. Presumably, it's responsible to the courts, although I would suspect if someone is aggrieved by a decision of the authority, they not only sue the authority, but they sue the state as well. And if they can't get relief from one, then they get relief from the other.
Tom, I'd like to move along here, if you don't mind, Representative Lehman, because we are running out of time.
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask Mr. Custer to clarify one statement that he made? Maybe he just misspoke himself, or maybe I don't understand my and Representative Boyer's legislation. I mean, I know that you're not very enthusiastic about it, but the legislation that I've sponsored and Representative Boyer sponsored doesn't leave a cloud on the title, and you said it did.
As far as I can see in my reading of the bill, and maybe I'm missing something, but I don't see anything in the bill that validates third-party title.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me just explain then for Mr. Custer how we do validate third-party title in the bill. The bill would say, as you look through the land, the bill would provide the following. The unencumbered land, the 212,000 acres, would be transferred to the authority. The title would be transferred to the authority. The third-party land with leases on it, such as Yusa Valley, Wishbone Hill, The land's been conveyed to municipalities. Would be purchased outright. The title would be free and clear because that would be purchased from the state, and the title would remain with the state. It would no longer be mental health lands. It would be purchased, and the money from that purchase would go into the principal of the trust. The LDA lands, the legislative designated area lands, would be transferred to the trust. The title would be held by the mental health authority, and the state would rent that LDA land from the authority. I don't think, quite honestly, that leaves a cloud in the title of any of that land. And I'm surprised. Perhaps what we got here is just a big misunderstanding of what the bill really does, and you need to look at it a little clearer, because quite honestly, it does not leave a cloud in the title.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond just briefly?
If you would, briefly.
I'll try to make it briefly. The bill also contains a number of remedies for the plaintiffs in the event the state fails to make a rental payment or a payment on principal. And those remedies include executing on any state account, which presumably would include the permanent fund, executing on unencumbered state land, taking over legislative designations, and the final line, I believe, is something like any other remedy available to the authority. Well, it seems to me that one of those remedies would, in fact, be going back to say, these were all inappropriate conveyances to third parties, and in fact, seeking to execute on those. Now, maybe that's an unlikely scenario, but if one walks through the bill, there's nothing in the bill that says, in fact, that those lands now have been taken out of trust status, and the authority will not be able to reach those in terms of its remedies, should it feel, or should there be a need for it to do so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's why we need to sit down at some point instead of just taking a hard-line position, Mr. Custer, why the administration needs to sit down and talk to us about the legislation, because I think those are problems that we can resolve in your mind.
So let's move on. Thank you very much, Mr. Custer. Appreciate the time. I'd like to call back the attorneys for plaintiffs, Mr. Jesse and Mr. Walker. And if we could... stay on target. I'm sorry that we
digress.
Before you get started, I would like to note for the record that we have been joined today by committee members, Representative Hudson, Representative Lehman, Vice Chairman Lincoln, Representative Carney, and Chairman Davidson, and also Senator Duncan. And Representative Boyer. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record again, this is David Walker. I'll do what I can to get us back on the track that I think the committee wants us to be on, which is the bills here. I think this discussion has been valuable. Basically, though, using your kind of language, I think you need to drop back and look at the bigger picture a little bit. Listening to Mr. Custer, it's apparent that there are a lot of things in controversy here. You know, one of the things that we all talk about is the potential harm to the third parties if the matter isn't resolved quickly. I think the court, that's been an issue that's been before the court. The court has remarked on it. Court has told us all that the court is not unmindful or unsympathetic to these problems, but the court's recognized that innocent third parties may be harmed. But the court using the court's language says, however, it must be stressed that the problem arises not because of actions of the plaintiffs in this court, but because of the actions of the state in violating its trust responsibilities when it redesignated the mental health trust lands as general grant lands in 1978. Now, putting a big quick gloss over it is, you can be sure, I suppose, that we would resist any opportunity to prize this case away from the Superior Court where it's on remand from the Supreme Court. And you can be sure that we believe that Representative Larson's bill does not reconstitute the trust in accordance with the Supreme Court's mandate, that the court has said that compensation is not the proper remedy. It's not in Representative Larson's bill a paying for the taking,
And the court has already ruled that the 1978 law was invalid. You can't breathe life back into it. So what am I saying? I don't want to debate that issue in front of you. What I'm saying is that there is a difference of opinion, and that Representative Larson's bill is something that doesn't constitute a settlement. It's not something that we agree to. And so if you proceed in that vein, you want to proceed in that vein, then it's like a horse race. That is the litigated solution. That's the litigated answer. And Mr. Custer and I have sincere differences of opinion about the outcomes of some of those issues. So if you're going to be in a horse race, you just need to know you're in a horse race, and you need to look at your horses, and you need to place your bets. If you don't want to do that, you want to have a negotiated resolution, then we need to talk about something that we've said is acceptable as a framework for settlement. That's the bills, Representative Boyer's bill that's before you, and I'd like to move it this time, if it's all right with the chair, to let Mr. Jesse describe the coalition position and walk through their thoughts about the Boyer legislation.
Please continue, Mr. Jesse.
Yes. Well, let me start on the asset side. Now, I don't want to get into, at this point in time, a debate about the valuation process. We've talked about that. No doubt there'll be more talk about that. I know that some people are concerned that it's too much. But one of the things, that the basic tenet that the plaintiffs and the beneficiaries have is that the trust needs to be compensated fairly. And at this point, the only valuation that we have that we can look to is the Intermental Health Trust valuation procedures, which lead to the valuation of the $2.243 billion. Now, one of the things that was obviously a big problem in last year's attempt to try to resolve this issue is people felt that apparently that the 8% rental on the entire $2.243 billion, or even some smaller number, was just too much, wasn't affordable. With the prospect of land values going up, that 8% going up while revenues went down, that this wasn't affordable to the state. And that if we were going to get a settlement, one of the things that we needed to do is enter into some kind of arrangement where the state could afford to make the trust whole. And so that's what we've been working on, is trying to come up with some way that this isn't the sort of bugaboo up there of $2.243 billion that people want to say will break the bank. Let me pass out this briefing paper. I would like to draw your attention, though, before I have this up here. It's also contained in this briefing paper on the second page, which is the asset side of the argument. Basically, this is how we tried to make this affordable to the state. What you do is you take the total land value of the $2.243 billion, and you remove from that the value, the unencumbered lands, which will return to the trust to be managed as trust lands. Now that, the portion of the total value that's attributable to the unencumbered lands is $107 million. Now that is then further reduced, we further reduce the $2.243 billion by taking the legislatively designated lands and renting them at 8% as a way to reduce the overall principal due on the note, if you will, that we're going to get to in a minute. Now that then leaves you with the sort of cash out, the mortgage, if you will, on the remaining lands, now getting down to 1.370. Now, depending, there's a lot of variables in here in terms of how you pay that off. You can pay it off with a larger down payment, a smaller down payment, but the purpose here is to try to develop a structured settlement that provides both fair compensation to the trust and also provides a mechanism under which the state can essentially afford to make the payments. If you'll turn to the first graph, this gives you a little bit more of an idea of how the actual payout follows over time. What this graph does is chart three different numbers in 1991 dollars, so we can talk about current dollars instead of hypothetical dollars. When we look at this, First of all, the purple line down at the bottom is the rental of the legislatively designated lands. Now, that starts at $61 million. The reason it goes up and down is the assumption that's been applied to that rental is that the legislatively designated lands will increase in value at the same rate of inflation. So I want to be clear about what our assumptions are. If the assumptions don't hold true, obviously, then you have to take that into consideration. It goes up and down because that revaluation happens every 5 years. Now, when that revaluation is done, the rental on that land obviously loses buying power in $91 until it's revalued and brought back up to a current value. So you see that in the purple line. The red line is the $1991 value of the essentially the mortgage payments that the state will make on the remaining $1.37 billion. Now you see that it starts at roughly $134 million. In $91 it goes down over the term of 30 years until you've essentially paid off that obligation. Now the total state obligation in any given year is a combination of the two lines. Now, in order to try to give you something to juxtapose the payments to, I used a figure of $110 million in orange as the current cost of the mental health program. Now, we don't want to go in right now, although at some point we could, the different approaches to getting a base to the mental health program. There's the mental health board base, which is somewhat lower than that. There's the Office of Management and Budget base, which is somewhat higher than that. But this is more or less the base that the House has talked about within a few million dollars. And that then, of course, is in $91 left constant. One thing that's been interesting for municipalities who have often argued that, well, you know, it can't be, we want a settlement, but it can't be too expensive. Because if it's too expensive, there's less money out of the general fund for our purposes for other things. And that will impinge on other state programs. One of the things that's been interesting, particularly in the Mat-Su Borough Assembly for them, was that by 2011, under this payment schedule, that the total combined payments of the mortgage in $91 plus the rental actually is lower than the current cost of the mental health program. Now, after that period of time, as time goes on, the state essentially gets in somewhat better of a position in the sense that the ongoing obligation is the 8% rental, but you have transferred the obligation for the operating budget expense of the mental health program over to the authority. Now, it will, of course, be making up what the declining buying power of the mortgage payments is by investing the corpus, the principal of that, into the corpus account and making earnings off of that in order to make up that difference. So one of the things we're trying to show with this is that it isn't something that breaks the bank. Even in the first year, outside of the down payment, you're looking at something in the neighborhood of $80 million or so over the current mental health program, which would be paid for out of the trust account. And then you do have a payment schedule. Moving on for a moment then to the program side, one of the things that we struggled with, and I know that many members on this committee are as concerned with as we are, and that is the historical pattern of the legislature being unable, in our view, to adequately carry out its responsibility as a trustee. When you create a trust, you divide ownership of property into two pieces. There's the legal owner who has the authority to do things with the money. And then there's the beneficial owner who has the entitlement to the benefit from that trust. Now, when you ask many people, which would you rather have, the legal ownership or the beneficial ownership, they'll mistakenly tell you, well, the legal ownership. That person has only the burdens and the responsibilities. It is their job to make sure that all the benefit from that money accrues to the beneficiaries. If I set up a trust for my son to go to college, and I made Representative Boyer the trustee and gave him this property, he would be able to manipulate that property, invest it, try to make money off of it, but my son Nicholas is the one that needs to benefit from that. Now, this is the problem we had when the Enabling Act was passed, when it created this conflict of interest, which allows the state, after first meeting the necessary expenses, to then use the income and proceeds from the trust for other purposes. If we use this in the trust for my son Nicholas, you see what would happen. We said, Representative Boyer, use this trust money, send my child to college, but anything you don't use to send him to college, you can use for your own purposes. Well, you can see, even with Representative Boyer, there's the temptation there to have my son not go to Stanford, but to go to a community college with borrowed books and drive down the expenditures from the trust in order to maximize the income to the trustee. Now, this is exactly what happened last year. Last year is a prime example of how this happens. You know, last year, this legislature passed a bill, the governor signed it, which transferred $80 million of trust fund into the general fund to balance the budget, while leaving homelessly mentally ill people on the street in Anchorage, while leaving chronic alcoholics without detox and long-term care, without dealing with the asbestos problem in API. I think people here must realize that when you enter API, you are warned that you are about to be exposed to an asbestos danger. Now, how can this help a paranoid schizophrenic? This is the kind of thing that the legislature has allowed to go on and has participated in for many years. Now, when we look at how to resolve this problem, we don't say that the Enabling Act somehow requires the creation of an independent trustee. It doesn't. We can go to court for years and years, and unless at some point the legislature is so unable to appropriate from the trust that we end up with a substitute trustee, you know, we are not, you're not required to have some other entity. But as Mr. Custer pointed out, this legislature was given the authority under the Enabling Act to, that you were allowed to make any law respecting mental health which you felt was appropriate. In a sense, what we're asking you to consider is to act as the highest trustee, because we're asking you to consider passing a law which would protect the beneficiaries from the trustees. Because our history with the state as trustee is such that we feel it's your duty to protect us, to protect the beneficiaries from having that trustee duty not carried out in the future. There also is nothing in the Enabling Act which prevents the legislature from delegating this authority to someone else. Our belief is that any reasonable trustee would give serious consideration to that. Now, people talk about they don't like the trust authority, that they don't want to give up this power. But what we haven't heard back, and what we hope that this committee and other committees and legislators will start to say, is, do you agree with us that there needs to be some way for this trust to be properly administered? If you believe there needs to be some way for the trust to be properly administered, then you need to give us some formulation, some framework under which we can look at what you're offering and say, this meets the requirement of having the trust administered as a trust by honest trustees. We know that the trust authority in Senate Bill 65 and House Bill 79 does that. We know that that trust authority will treat this as a trust. We're not saying that that's the only mechanism that's possible for this trust to become a real trust, but we're saying we know this works. To move forward, we need your involvement and your participation in either modifying the trust authority in this bill to some comfort level that you have, or in coming up with some other formulation of a trustee relationship that you feel, not only just because you want to settle this lawsuit, but because you care about the beneficiaries and you have a responsibility to those beneficiaries to see that they're protected in the future.
Representative Carney?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You make some very compelling arguments. it's my opinion that the concept of giving the people control of their programs is a good concept. I don't think there's any way that we're ever going to give you this stream of money from the legislative, you know, from general fund on a yearly basis as payment for the land. I would suggest that we consider going to a, you know, decreasing that amount of debt with land rather than with cash or you know, a note to be paid off for a period of time. Otherwise, I don't think we can get this thing done.
Well, now we're talking. That's what negotiations and settlements are all about. That's exactly the kind of dialogue we need to get into. You need to understand that we thought we were going to have an administration to negotiate with. We thought we were going to have an administration, which, by the way, agreed in the campaign to every single concept that are in these two bills. We don't have that administration to negotiate. You understand, as we're coming to understand more and more every day, the difficulties of negotiating a settlement of this scale, of this complexity, with a legislative body of 60 individuals, many of whom have their own ideas about how this ought to be done. But we need to get a more positive attitude that yes, we can and we will work out a settlement. Because Mr. Custer, I've heard Mr. Custer, and I respect him a great deal. We've worked with him for many years. But this is the same story we've heard from the state and from him for years and years. The state has the power. The state can do this. He was the attorney in this case. That's what he told the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, you don't have the power. That's what he's been telling Judge Green. And Judge Green has consistently said, no, you can't do this. What I don't hear is the trustee relationship to the beneficiaries. I hear concern about the third parties. I hear concern about the legislative prerogatives. What I don't hear is how are we going to protect the beneficiaries? If you can get your mindset in how can you protect the beneficiaries, we've got our mindset on how can we make it affordable? What other things can we do which still gives fair compensation to the trust? We can work out a deal. And those are the ideas that we need. But we need some mechanism and a commitment and an optimistic attitude that it can be done.
Senator Lincoln?
Thank you. I forget how many days this is now that we've sat in on the mental health trust issue. And when our chairman says that we're getting all of these bills out by next week, I find that very optimistic indeed. And I wish him luck in doing that. Some of the in listening to this dialogue here about the bilateral versus the unilateral settlement, in going over what a unilateral settlement is, I guess that I kind of wiped that off my sheet, that that's something that now I've set aside, that now I'm looking at a bilateral settlement. And with that, two questions just arise that in the chairman's optimism on getting things moving, that the Superior Court Judge Green's briefing, I guess it is, on